In a time long, long ago, that would be the late 1950s, America's fears over the communist threat reached a new height after the Soviet Union put the satellite Sputnik into orbit. Suddenly, America was trailing badly in a competition that would come to define the next decade, the race to space. As then-Senator Lyndon Johnson put it, I'll be damned if I sleep by the light of a red moon. So in the spring of 1959, America kicked off its space age, introducing the country's first astronauts, the Mercury 7. Their story is well known. What's not is the story of their wives. In her new book, The Astronaut Wives Club, author Lily Coppell recounts the true life tale of those women, women who in an instant were catapulted into the public eye on a grand scale.
I really see them as America's first reality stars. These women who were unknown military wives in the background, married to test pilots, obviously had to be pretty brave to even be married to a man with that kind of high-risk job. But all of a sudden, America is looking to them as model housewives, and they're going to have a role throughout the space race of presenting the perfect American family to the rest of the world.
Which Life magazine accommodated them in doing, because it immediately made it quite a lucrative offer to the seven families so that they could have special access. Tell us about the cover of your book, which is a Life magazine photograph, and you describe these wives as standing around this capsule looking like models showing off a Maytag.
Absolutely. This particular picture was the wives' first Life magazine cover shot. And you see these different characters emerge. Rene Carpenter, who's platinum blonde and quite glamorous. Annie Glenn, who was married to John, had a stutter, so she preferred not to say too much. Betty Grissom was from Indiana, and all the other wives saw her as less sophisticated. But it's a quite humorous situation because Life magazine asked all of the wives to wear pastel shirtwaist dresses. Of course, all the wives show up in the prescribed dress, except for Rene Carpenter, who shows up in this
sundress, almost like an evening gown.
Yeah, it's a bit of a cocktail number, and it's splashed with these big pink and red roses. And the other wives thought it was pretty bold. She wowed them and I think really made the photo.
Well, let's talk about Annie Glenn. Of course, John Glenn has got to be the most famous of all the astronauts. Their marriage also was seen as perfect by all the other wives. Read us a little passage of your description of Annie Glenn.
Okay. Annie was just what NASA wanted the wives of its seven astronauts to be, a squeaky clean American housewife standing proudly beside her husband with her spatula, ready to whip up something tasty for her hero who is beating those godless Russians in the space race.
Which is a delightful description of what, in fact, was a very good marriage.
They definitely had the right stuff as a couple. I mean, they met as toddlers in a playpen and are still together to this day.
Of course, some of these marriages were as perfect as they were presented, but there was a lot of temptation for these guys.
Yeah, these guys were alpha dogs, and during the week, they are down at Cape Canaveral in Florida, and they're training, but they're also unwinding. And they're followed by astronaut groupies, this new breed, which are referred to as Cape Cookies, young, pretty, tanned girls who want nothing more than to meet one of America's new astronauts.
So you had some of these guys being real flyboys, not even being so discreet. Others, the marriages were good, but women were used to their husbands being away and being fully dedicated to this job.
Absolutely. These women were really in it to support their husbands from the very beginning. One of the early prerequisites was no solid marriage, no space flight. Rene Carpenter told me, you know, we were entertaining machines, eyes glued on our husbands' careers. Betty Grissom, she worked like hell to put Gus through engineering school, so much that he later looked back and he told her, you know, you're really the astronaut in this family.
Well, that gets us to what might be called the ultimate test for the wives. And that was launch day, the day of the mission. They really had to develop from scratch how to deal with all the sort of pomp and the press and then this terrible anxiety because really no one knew if this was safe.
No, and all of the original seven wives had all seen an early test firing where the rocket blew up in front of their eyes. And from the beginning, they sort of developed this gallows humor. But launch day was the true test, and that really became to define what this strange new role of being one of America's astronaut wives was.
Well, the ultimate fear, of course, was that there would come a day when a husband would not come back. And that did happen to one of these original Mercury 7 wives, Betty Grissom, on January 27th, 1967.
Yeah, it's one of the first NASA tragedies. Three men were caught inside the Apollo 1 capsule, which burst into flames. They all died on the ground during this pre-flight test.
We find out that Gus Grissom had told Betty just what he wanted in case he ever didn't come back. And she did what he wanted.
Yeah, Betty is a completely original American character and someone who has a lot of heart. She's in her late 80s. She remembers with such clarity these moments that passed between her and Gus. He never liked Betty wearing black. He thought it was morbid. And he told her once, "If I die, I want you to have a party." And she just looked at him and she said, "Okay, we'll have a party."
You did spend many hours talking with these women. One thing, the club of the title of your book, the Astronaut Wives Club, it did exist. But what has that come to symbolize for them?
These women were a tight band of sisters. And it really went back to the idea that they were thrust into this new role and that their husbands were incredibly competitive. And they basically turned to each other from day one and they said, if there's any way that we're going to survive in this sort of cutthroat NASA world, we're going to have to exist above the competition and really band together. And the women, in fact, they've maintained stronger bonds than the astronauts themselves.
Author Lily Coppell, her new book is The Astronaut Wives Club. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Drought conditions in much of the country have eased, but the Great Plains region is still in trouble. The nation's cattle herd is down to 1950s numbers. As Luke Runyon of member station KUNC reports from Colorado, that means the price of beef will go up this summer just in time for grilling season.
At Edwards Meats in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, near Denver, grinders churn out a steady stream of ground beef. Workers divvy up the bright red meat into trays and slide one into a glass display case. A laminated price tag is the final touch. Recently, the number on that slip of paper has been getting higher.
In the last 3 weeks, it's really jumped. Most of our prices have gone up at least $1 a pound or more.
Owner Darren Edwards says you always see a price increase when people start firing up their backyard grills. But this year is different. Prices for certain cuts of beef have jumped to historic highs, giving sticker shock to some of his loyal customers.
We have that happen sometimes. You throw a couple big, thick T-bone steaks up on the scale and it's $30-$40. They're like, yeah, I can't afford those.
Edwards says it's the same story for New York strips, tenderloins, and ribeyes. About 90 miles east in the small ranching community of Last Chance, rancher Gerald Schreiber pulls handfuls of weeds from dusty soil.
I'm not very optimistic right in this spot.
Last summer, a combination of drought, wildfire, and wind transformed Schreiber's pastures into a blanket of invasive, noxious weeds. The fields haven't recovered.
There's a lot of dead plants right in this area, and that's what we find.
Here's the reason for the price increase. There just isn't enough feed. Because of the drought, there's a smaller supply of hay and dense grasses. Ranchers are having a tough time finding feed, And when they do, it's more expensive. During the winter, Schreiber paid more than double what he usually does for hay. Recent research shows more than half of the country's beef cattle are in states where the pasture can't support large herds.
This is pretty unpredictable country. You got to get the rose-colored glasses off, like we're doing here.
A rancher has to make a decision.
That's Elaine Johnson, a market analyst with CattleHedging.com.
Do I buy expensive hay and try to hang on for another year, or do I just liquidate my cows? Tighter and tighter supplies means higher and higher prices.
And higher prices mean more people could choose to forego burgers and steaks this summer. Sales of beef have been down so far this year, while less expensive options like pork are up. Johnson says expect to pay more for beef until ranchers can build up their herds.
When you have a drought like this and have liquidated numbers significantly, it typically means that supplies will going to be reduced for 2, 3 to 4 years. And it's one of the reasons why we've seen such a big increase in beef prices.
Back at Edwards Meats, owner Darren Edwards says even with the higher prices, he's absorbing some of the cost. That's not something he can keep up for long.
Hopefully it does come back down. If it doesn't come back down in the next couple weeks, we'll have to adjust our prices accordingly.
Right, sure. So, I mean, eventually you see that in your bottom line.
For sure. We just kind of bite the bullet for a little bit.
He'll be waiting a while. Most economists say prices will stay high the rest of the year. For NPR News, I'm Luke Runyon in Greeley, Colorado.
That story is from Harvest Public Media, a public radio project reporting on agriculture and food production issues.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, American high school graduation rates are the highest they've been in 40 years, but still, nearly a million students a year drop out. So we'll take a look at what's working and what's not in this area in just a few minutes. But first, we go to matters of personal finance. You might have noticed that interest rates are inching back up. There's talk that the Federal Reserve might be easing up on its efforts to stimulate the economy by keeping interest rates low. If that does happen and interest rates continue to rise, that affects a lot of people. So we wanted to talk more about this, so we've called upon, once again, one of our money coaches, Robin Farzad. He's a contributor to Bloomberg Businessweek, and he's with us once again. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle. How are you?
So what is going on with interest rates?
So you've seen interest rates back up and creep up over the past month or so since Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, gave testimony where he said that they could taper their unprecedented stimulus. In addition to keeping short-term interest rates near zero, the Federal Reserve has been buying on the order of $85 billion a month of bonds and mortgage securities, and that was never intended to be permanent.
I guess the point being it would have to end sometimes, but who would be most affected if it were? And would this be a shock to the economy, which we understand is now growing but not fast enough to absorb all the people who are unemployed, all the people who are still looking, and all the people who've been harmed by the troubles
sure.
in recent years?
To the extent that interest rates rise, interest rates are embedded in everything. They're baked into everything from home loans to auto loans to stock prices to projects that corporate executives take on for their companies. If the government has to pay more to borrow money over 10 years, then Michelle Martin has to pay more. Then any person who walks into a home loan office has to pay more. So there's this idea that it would crowd out many people and hurt them in terms of their borrowing costs.
What's the argument in favor of easing off on this stimulus and letting interest rates rise?
Well, it was never intended to be forever. It was an emergency measure, obviously, with a lot of the other things that the Federal Reserve has done in the wake of the financial crisis. As I mentioned, they kept short-term rates at 0%. Now that they notice that the stock market and the housing market are resurgent, job market participation might be inching up, even though the unemployment rate is still uncomfortably high. They're realizing that it's time at some point, this is not permanent, to pull back the stimulus a bit. They're not going to take it all away at once, but maybe you take $85 billion a month to $65 billion a month. Maybe then you take it to $45 billion a month. And then at that point, you have to convey to the world that, well, we're doing this gradually and we want to make sure that the economy could stand out on its own.
Well, we do understand that the Fed is going to meet later this month. What factors
are they likely to evaluate, to decide whether to let rates start to go up or not? I mean, you were one of the people who was telling us that, yes, it's true that the housing market is coming back, but a lot of the people buying these homes are investors. So the average homeowner isn't participating in this. I mean, clearly there are sort of philosophical questions at work here, but what factors is the Fed likely to consider to decide what to do here?
The Fed looks at unemployment and inflation. Obviously, inflation is under check, but unemployment is still naggingly high. But they also, I think, implicitly look at other things. They look at the stock market being pretty much at a record. They look at housing being not just recovering right now, but being hot in certain markets. You have speculators and investors back. And not just that, you have people who relied on interest rates being low for refinancing, so existing homeowners. So it affects everyone out there. I mean, it's the rate that's on the tips of every trader's mouth, on the tips of their tongue, that you have to monitor this thing because it's embedded in every risk asset class in the world.
Obviously, how you react to this depends on who you are. You know, are you trying to buy a house? Are you trying to retire? But being as general as you can, are there things that people can do to prepare for this possibility that interest rates might start rising again?
If you're a prospective mortgage holder, you have to ask yourself if you're going to play chicken with this game. You think rates are going to fall back down again and stay on the sidelines and wait for that to happen? Or if you think rates are heading higher, it might be a good time to lock in the mortgage that you are eyeing right now. In addition, rising rates, rising bond yields hurt bond investors. I know it sounds opposite to what you would think typically, but you have to look at your bond portfolios and see what the sensitivity would be to rising rates. This is still an open question for the entire economy. How does the economy coming out of this economic calamity deal with more normal interest rates, ones that are not really set by the Federal Reserve's taking on extraordinary policy?
Is there anybody who would benefit from interest rates rising?
The certain people who have been short the market, who are short sellers, who have betted that interest rates would rise, certain people who are out there that thought that inflation would be a factor, who invested maybe in gold. It's a very tricky question. And because it's not all set by the Federal Reserve, it's set by the market. And we don't know. You could play out 1,000 different scenarios and how the world would react to higher bond yields. And that's why this is so vexingly difficult for traders and for homeowners and for investors right now.
It may be a silly question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, which is the Fed open to lobbying? I mean, do people write letters and, you know, bring signs saying, keep the interest rates low because I'm about to buy a house? Or does that work?
The Fed is an independent body. It's not open to that kind of jawboning. It's supposed to be nonpartisan. But there are certain things that they pay attention to formally, like unemployment and inflation. I think informally, if they see the stock market tank, if they see the bond market tank, maybe they would think twice about doing something like this. But again, it was never intended to be permanent. And the tricky thing is, how do you withdraw it gradually to the extent that it was never intended to be permanent?
At this time next year, what kind of conversation do you think we'll be having about this?
I think we'll be talking about pain in the bond market, frankly. I think that, you know, we're 5 years into this interest rate policy, and sometimes you have to come out of it. I think unemployment is not recovering the way anybody would want it to be recovering, but you have stock markets at an all-time high. You have housing in certain pockets that's very hot, and the world has to come to terms with a normal U.S. bond market, not one that's being treated under emergency circumstances. Okay. And that's the big open question for us.
Robin Farzad is a contributor to Bloomberg Business Week. We caught up with him in Richmond, Virginia. Robin, thank you.
My pleasure, Michelle.
Now, as the school year winds down across the country, we'd like to turn to some good news in education. High school graduation rates are at a 40-year high. Across the country, 75% of students are earning a high school diploma. That's up from 66% just 10 years ago, according to a new report by Education Week. And some of the biggest gains come from Latino and African American students who are finishing high school at the highest rates ever. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called Chris Swanson. He's the Vice President of Editorial Projects in Education. That's a nonprofit group that published this new report together with Education Week. He's here in Washington, D.C. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
For additional perspective, we've also called Michaela Ron, who founded LearningWorks. That's a charter school dedicated to helping some of those kids who weren't making it across the finish line, who were, in fact, dropping out in the Los Angeles area. She's with us from member station KPCC in Pasadena. Michaela, welcome to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris, I'm going to start with you. What's going on here? Why do we see high school graduation rates growing?
We've been looking at this issue in Diplomas Canada report for about 8 years now. And as you've already mentioned, we've seen a really strong rise over this period of time. And this starts at a period maybe about 10 years ago when the issue of graduation dropout was not even on the national agenda, which is kind of a strange thing to think about at this point in time. A lot of what's behind these increases we're seeing and the consistency across groups is really the consistent focus over the past decade on this as an important issue, educationally, as well as how it feeds into the economy.
Are there specific supports that have been put into place, or do you think it's just more of a kind of a talking it up, like a bully pulpit type of situation?
You know, it's a little bit of both. And I think one of the things that we've come to realize through research and reform that's been going on the ground is one of the big challenges that school systems face is understanding what their challenge is. Students who have dropped out, who are at risk of dropping out, are very different from one another and are very different from one community to another. Before, say, the past 10 years, school systems had surprisingly little hard data and information about their students, especially ones who had already left. And so a first step being understanding what the needs of your students are. Do you have an overage at-risk population, or these students who are just, you know, struggling academically in general? Once schools and school systems can get their heads around that, then they can think about matchmaking the needs of their students to the solutions that are going to work best for them.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about new news about the high school graduation rate in the United States. It is at a 40-year high. We're talking about this with Chris Swanson. He's Vice President of Editorial Projects in Education. He published this new information. Also with us, Michaela Ron, who founded LearningWorks. That's a charter school dedicated to helping kids finish school who have previously dropped out. The rates for Latinos increased by 5.4% from 2009 to 2010, and they increased 3.3% for African Americans for the same period. Still, around 1 million students nationwide are not graduating on time this graduation season. So, Michael, what have you observed about why kids are dropping out, and what kinds of things tend to help them make it across the finish line?
One of the concepts in prevention is, yes, awareness helps and higher expectations in schools help. And that helps the graduation rate, meaning students who might be floundering at the school, getting the D's and the F's or hanging out on the benches or the attendance, those are the ones we can quickly grab if the adults are paying attention and get them to the stage. And that increases the graduation rate. I think an interesting concept in the report that we're talking about is the epicenters, where there are high dropout rates that still exist. And I work in one of those epicenters. And in those cases, dropouts need a different strategy. In our program, it's completely structured different, and the students aren't required to be there all the time. They come for what they need. And so I think it's important to look at graduation rate and dropout rate separately, and they require different interventions. One's more of a prevention strategy, and one's more of an intervention strategy.
To your point, what the report talks about is, as you said, epicenters where the graduation rate is either dropping or staying the same. LA is one, Chicago is one, Denver, Dallas, Albuquerque, New Mexico is one. Chris, why don't you pick up the thread here? Why do we think this is? I mean, these are urban systems. There's a lot of turnover in a lot of these systems. Maybe there's a lot of churning in the student population. Maybe there's a lot of kind of people coming and going. A lot of times there are a lot of immigrant groups there too. Maybe English isn't the first language. I mean, what are some of the factors that you're seeing here?
Those are all factors that you see a lot. And when you look at this epicenter list, these are school systems that are large and have low graduation rates. And that's what gets you on the list. And so New York, Los Angeles, you know, the big urban districts tend to be the ones that pop up, even if there's larger districts elsewhere in the country. And it is, I think, what we see in especially kind of big city districts that have histories of low performance. It's a combination of factors that all comes down in the same place. Our public schools are reflections of the communities they serve. These are often communities that have high rates of poverty, histories of segregation, histories of low-performing schools. They may be well-resourced or not, but, you know, the dollars aren't everything. Students who are in these communities, and often they don't have the good kind of family or neighborhood supports that, you know, affluent suburbs would have, these epicenters. There's lots of challenges. There's progress being made. New York is, you know, at the top of the list. It's also by far the largest district in the country. They've been making steady improvements. And so even if you're on the list, it doesn't mean that good things can't be happening. But the bar is very high in terms of the level of challenge.
But Michael, I still want to push you on a sort of question of the kinds of things that you think work here, and you make a point of intervening before kids drop out and also recovering the kids who have already dropped out. And you're saying that you need different strategies here. So let's talk first about the kids before they drop out. What are the kinds of things that you see work?
The area that everybody needs to be focusing on is middle school and ninth grade. When you look at a ninth grade transcript, you really know the story. You know if they're UC bound in California, they're going off to Harvard, or if they're in the average pack, or if they're struggling to graduate, or if they're going to be a dropout. I mean, I see transcripts that have straight Fs all the way through ninth grade, and they have zero credits. So the prevention student is the one that's hanging on, and the intervention student isn't even hanging on. The schools really need to look at that data early on to make determinations of what's going on with these students, and most of it is correlated to poverty. And so how can we put the supports in place to make sure these students are attending and getting the engaging teachers? Because it also comes down to relationship. If there is no relationship or reason for that student to be at school, they won't be there.
And the recoverable youth is kind of a terrible term, isn't it? I mean, it sounds like recycling. But I understand the intention of it is that maybe the kid's already dropped out, but you can get him or her back in. So, Michael, talk a little bit about what are the strategies that you find working there. Well, one of the things you were telling us earlier is just the traditional school day is a non-starter for this population. Why is that?
Imagine a student who's been out of school for 6 to 8 months. They've been on their couch. They had no one getting them off the couch. There was no parental push. Sometimes the parents don't even know that they are a dropout. The schools aren't calling you. They're not coming to find you. If you decide to get off that couch and go back to school, you are not going to go back to school 3 to 6 hours a day in a continuation school. You've lost all your habits. And so we've created a school that's very alternative in that students come like a college to the credits and activities that they need in order to graduate. And the more that they feel the relationship and see the success that they have, the more hours they put in. And by towards graduation, they're there 40 hours plus a week.
Overall, though, we've presented this as good news. Is it? I mean, there are still a million kids dropping out every year in an economy that increasingly requires a lot more education than high school. So Chris, you know, final thought, how should we feel about this? Is this a good news story?
It's good news, but I think we should not sit back and rest on our laurels. There are still a million kids a year who are not earning diplomas. That's not enough. And as we've seen the graduation rate increase, the demands for highly educated people in the economy just increase and increase and increase. And it's not just that people want more. There's very little for people without at least a high school education to be doing. Even kind of fields that we've thought about as potentially offering a stable middle-class life in generations gone by, skilled trades, blue-collar work, those jobs either don't exist anymore for the most part or are much more technical and require higher levels of education and training. I think it's good to acknowledge progress where it's been made, but the job's not done. And I think anybody who looks at our report or looks at any number of communities around the country can see that even one student falling through the cracks is too many.
Michael, a final thought from you? Is this a good news story?
I was surprised by it because I'm in an epicenter, and I'm excited by it because it means that the expectations, I think, have increased, and the issue is we have more awareness over the issue of dropouts because it is an economy issue. It is something we need to focus on. But in those epicenters, I think everybody needs to do what they can to, as we call it, chase kids back and reengage them in their education.
Michael Aron is principal and founder of Learning Works. That's a charter school in the Pasadena area that works to get kids who've dropped out of school back into school. She's also recently elected to the Pasadena Unified School District Board. She was with us from KPCC in California. Here in Washington, D.C., Chris Swanson. He's vice president of editorial projects in education. Thank you both so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's hard being a modern dad, especially when your kid does something like this.
He had gone onto Facebook and used an alias, made his age to be 18, and he was chatting with friends of his at school in the middle of the night.
Does father still know best? Our panel has been there and serves up some advice just in time for Father's Day. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Tyler Saladino is one of thousands of players hoping to make it to the major leagues. He plays in Birmingham, Alabama, for an affiliate of the Chicago White Sox. Last year, Morning Edition profiled Saladino through the ups and downs of his season. NPR's Russell Lewis talked to him again to see how he's doing.
One of the biggest changes this year is where the Birmingham Barons and Tyler Saladino play. No longer out in the suburbs, but in a sparkling new ballpark right downtown.
Programs! Get your programs right here! $1!
The stadium has generated renewed interest and enthusiasm. Attendance is up, fans are excited, and it's translated on the field. The Barons are in first place in the Southern League, playing some of their best ball in years. While winning is fun, Tyler Saladino says that doesn't change his approach to the game.
Whether it's opening day, middle of July, last game of the season, you're not in the big leagues and your career isn't over, so you have to work at the stuff that you do. You work at your craft day in and day out.
That kind of attitude is one reason why the Chicago White Sox like the 23-year-old so much. He's an infielder playing either at shortstop or second base. But Saladino's a real student of the game, thinking as much about the art of base running as being fast.
2-0, the Barons lead. We are in the last of the sixth inning. Swing, line drive towards center fielder Peterson. Back he goes, this one over his head for an extra base hit. Saladino will park it at second with a double.
Saladino is one of about 6,000 minor leaguers playing on 190 teams around the country, all vying for a single thing, make it to the big leagues. It's not easy. Most won't get there. Saladino's coaches all think he will, though. Here's Barons manager Julio Vinas.
You know, that all comes with experience. That's something that really can't be taught. You know, the only thing I am is I'm firm that you got to play hard and do things right. And he's one of those guys that plays hard and he always does things right. So good things always happen for him.
Tyler Saladino got promoted last year, sent to the White Sox AAA team in Charlotte, just one notch below the major leagues. Saladino says that stint really changed his outlook, especially watching how more veteran ball players prepare and handle themselves.
Just the time that I got to spend up there was a huge opportunity for me to learn about a lot about myself, a lot about the maturity side of baseball, how you have to just go about it every day.
A few weeks after he went to Charlotte, though, the White Sox returned him to Birmingham.
Not for one split second do I feel he's disappointed about being back in Double-A where he was last year.
That's Kurt Bloom, the Barons broadcaster. He's called games for 25 years. He noticed something about Tyler Saladino, the way he dealt with what others might consider a demotion.
He's made that mental adjustment. A lot of other people over the years go, why am I back? There's nothing else I can do. That's not the case. He's not looked at. I think he's here enjoying it, polishing his skills, getting better, knowing the next time he leaves, he won't come back.
Earlier this season, Saladino slumped at the plate. In April, he went hitless in 5 straight games, and then it happened again in May. Baseball is as much mental as it is physical. Battling through a slump is what successful players must do. Tyler Saladino says he's changed a lot since last season.
You got to grow up at some point, you know, and I think last year, that time that I spent in Charlotte is when that happened for me, when I realized that.
Tyler Saladino says as long as he plays for the Barons, he has just one goal, make it to the playoffs, and along the way, have some fun and keep improving his game. Russell Lewis, NPR News, Birmingham.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
The recent leaks of classified documents about government surveillance have raised a lot of questions about the loss of privacy. And experts will tell you there is another casualty, secrecy. Classified documents used to be kept in a safe and read by a select few who couldn't take them from the room. Now, many top secret documents can be accessed by hundreds, if not thousands, of people, creating a security nightmare, as NPR's Dina Temple-Raston reports.
Stealing classified documents used to be decidedly low-tech. Just think about ex-communist Whitaker Chambers. He accused State Department employee Alger Hiss of spying for the Soviet Union. This is Chambers' testimony about Hiss before the House Committee on Un-American Activities in 1948.
Mr. Hiss represents the concealed enemy against which we are all fighting and I am fighting.
The damning evidence in that case was a small piece of microfilm Chambers had stored in a hollowed-out pumpkin.
We're a long way from that now.
That's Joel Brenner. He worked at the National Security Agency. He was the inspector general there.
You can walk out of a building with a zip drive or a USB stick on the end of your keychain with all of the information that's in that building and walk right out without sweating a bit or anybody noticing what you're doing. That's a very different world we're in.
That may be what happened in this latest case involving a former NSA contractor named Edward Snowden. Here he is speaking to the Guardian newspaper.
When you're in positions of privileged access, like a systems administrator for these sort of intelligence community agencies, you're exposed to a lot more information on a broader scale than the average employee.
And that gets to a key point. It isn't just more difficult to maintain privacy in this new era. Brenner says it's harder to keep secrets, too.
The public thinks that privacy and secrecy are somehow different and that privacy's gone through the floor while secrecy's gone through the roof. And the truth is, they've both gone through the floor. They're both in the gutter and for the same set of technological and cultural reasons.
Culturally, we're sharing everything. Where we're eating on Foursquare, who we're dating on Facebook. Technologically, all this sharing takes place on networks that aren't exactly secure. And private citizens aren't the only ones using them.
Companies and governments use the same IT infrastructure to communicate as we do.
Joel Brenner, the former NSA official, says that's a problem if you're trying to keep secrets.
Organizations and governments are losing information in the same way that people are.
And, just like in business, the government needs someone to keep their networks running. They need IT guys, and those people are becoming very powerful. Investigators are looking at what Edward Snowden's administrator permissions gave him access to and which secrets he might have been able to retrieve.
You know, we call this stuff top secret, but if 1,000 people have access to it, it may be called top secret, but there's some important sense in which it's not so secret anymore. You know, Ben Franklin had it right when he said, 3 can keep a secret if 2 of them are dead.
U.S. officials say that Snowden, who appeared to be in Hong Kong just yesterday, has disappeared. Glenn Greenwald of the Guardian newspaper has promised more leaks to come. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered.